You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. Every Wednesday, we bring in a panel of doctors and other health professionals to get us updated and to also answer our questions about coronavirus. So if you have a question for our doctors today, make sure you send us an email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Joining us today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, as well as a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Laura McGeorge, St. Luke's Health System Medical Director, Primary and Specialty Care, and Dr. Darren Lee, Emergency Room Physician and Vice President of Medical Affairs, St. Alphonsus Medical Center in Nampa. Happy Wednesday, everybody.
Hello, Gemma.
Hi, Gemma.
Hello. So can we, Dr. Pate, can I start with you? And can we get just an overview of where Idaho is with COVID? We have been seeing a downward trend, yet we had a three-day holiday weekend and schools are opening back up. So my question is what we are seeing with this downward trend, do you think, is it going to last or could those numbers go back up?
Yeah, sadly, I don't think this is going to last. I certainly am pleased that the numbers are going down, and this is certainly good news. But first of all, let me put it into perspective. Even though it's going down, on most days, our number of new cases are still more than what we were at our first peak back in March and April. Secondly, our hospitals have twice as many patients with COVID in them today as we did at the worst point in that first surge. So, you know, the first thing is just put it in perspective. Yes, things are getting better, but this does not mean that COVID's gone away or things are safe. And then, as you mentioned in your question, Gemma, there's a whole bunch of things that from an epidemiological standpoint are getting ready to get changed, and I fear changed for the worse. So as you mentioned, we just had the Labor Day weekend. We wouldn't expect to see changes yet, but I'm sure we will. And we know that recently we've been having a lot of exposures related to people getting together in backyard barbecues, family, non-family. So I certainly do expect a number of cases from that. On top of it, just as you mentioned, for a lot of schools, they just resumed in-person classes yesterday. And I think from what I've seen, schools have varying degrees of comprehensive operational plans, some far better than others. And I think we will see problems at the schools that don't have as robust operating plans. And then, on top of everything, when people see the numbers go down, they typically begin to use less caution. So that may aggravate it. We've got colleges and universities getting going, and that has been a problem across the country with spreading cases. Further, with the cases coming down, as you've heard, Central District Health is talking about the potential of reopening bars. And then we also have sports getting kicked off. And then we have the upcoming cold and flu season. So, I mean, I think you can list almost 10 different things that are not going to be good factors for us. And I suspect in the next several weeks, we should be seeing probably what is going to be the beginning of another surge.
Dr. Lee, I'm curious to know what you are seeing at St. Alphonsus. Dr. Pate mentioned, you know, more patients coming in. Is that a trend you've been seeing within your organization?
Yeah, so I would echo a lot of what he said. We have seen, you know, we saw a lot more patients coming in. And as you know, admissions from the emergency department or admissions to the hospital are a lagging indicator of cases. But we have seen over the last couple of weeks that we're seeing less patients presenting to the emergency department. There are other places they are presenting, but we're seeing less cases, which is reflected in the Idaho numbers that we're seeing. But as Dr. Pate mentioned, you know, this is, we've been doing a lot of mitigation efforts to try to get to this point right now. And as we see that some of those mitigation efforts are being pulled back, we do expect that that, again, will it lead to an increased number of cases. We have to remember that the total number of people in Idaho who have been, let's say, who have contracted COVID and those who have would, you know, test positive for antibodies is still very, very, very low. So there's still a huge population of the public that is still susceptible to this virus. And as we change things, which is definitely happening, if you just read the news and what people are doing, and I think he's correct as well, as people see the numbers come down and they start to become less less cautious, and we'll see an impact from that.
And Dr. McGeorge, same question. What are you seeing with St. Luke's?
Yes, thanks, Gemma. Our numbers too, again, just like Dr. Lee was speaking about, we are seeing our hospital numbers coming down. I agree with both Dr. Pate and Dr. Lee that, again, you know, with what is going on in the community, with the sports, with schools going back, with gatherings that we've seen over Labor Day, we certainly will expect to see numbers go up again. And I want to really reiterate that, you know, we are learning. COVID-19 is a new disease and we are learning a lot. But what we have seen really with both peaks so far is that the first thing we'll start to see is that cases may go up in the community, and then we may see hospitalizations go up. And then is where we, after that, you know, there's always a lag between cases, hospitalizations, and even then mortality tends to lag even behind that. So for now, yes, we're seeing, we also are seeing a dip in our hospitalizations. Our numbers now in the hospital are about as far down as they were during our peak in April. So it's not great, but it is much better than it was, say, end of July.
And I'm curious about Central District Health yesterday moving Ada County into the yellow category. Now, Dr. Pate, and I'm curious about it because that going into that yellow category allows for schools to open in some type of capacity with, you know, in-person learning. And as you mentioned, then bars could potentially reopen. Is there a concern that with going into the yellow category, really before we've actually truly even been a week into K-12 school, that they're making this move, and could we see that uptick?
Well, Jim, that's exactly what I'm afraid of. You know, the Central District Health is certainly caught in a tough spot. They're trying to provide some metrics that are less subjective, more able to be followed, and so people can kind of see how we're going. You know, the problem is that it doesn't take into consideration all these prognostic factors that I mentioned to you at the beginning of the show, of all the things that are lined up and what can happen. The public health data and determination for where we are is really just a snapshot in time. Okay, here's where we are. So I do fear that what's going to happen is we just went into yellow this week, but when they look at these numbers in 2 weeks, we'll probably be going back into red. And, you know, I don't know if our communities are well served by this kind of going in and out, but certainly they're facing a lot of pressure from these bars and others that want to be open. And I think the other thing that has just frankly been appalling to me is, given all the advice that the public health districts have come out with and the assessments of the community spread, we've then seen some school districts just essentially disregard it and act in extreme difference to what that advice and status is. So it's really a tough spot.
And Dr. Lee and Dr. McGeorge, I'm curious about your thoughts on, you know, on these categories and Ada County going into the yellow when we've just come out of the Labor Day weekend and school is starting. And Dr. Lee, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, this is really difficult because, you know, everybody like myself, I'd love my kids to go back to school. Mm-hmm. And we'd all like to kind of go back to some sense of normality. But this is, it's so hard to judge ahead of time. And so we're watching trends. But if you ever watch and see where how those trend lines go, there's a wide berth of what they can do. So if you continue to do the same thing, the trend tends to go in a down way. But as you change, like Dr. Pate said, you're going to see a change. I mean, it's not hard to imagine what's going to happen when we have larger gatherings, when we open bars. I mean, I have two children and I can tell you they don't know how to social distance. You know, they try, they're happy wearing their masks and doing those things. They like to wash their hands, but you know, one of the most important things is social distancing. And it's just really difficult when you're dealing with children. And then bars are probably very similar. I mean, they will set things up and they will try their best, but it's just difficult to maintain that social distance and allow the most effective means of stopping the virus to take place.
And Dr. McGeorge, your thoughts on that?
Yes, thanks. I know we all want to see our kids back in school. And I think there is a lot of evidence that it's important, you know, kids, depending on different challenges they may have, it is very difficult for them to learn by distance or virtually. That being said, it does have to very much be balanced by what's going on with this pandemic. I think, you know, it's challenging because the children probably at the age where they most need in-person schooling are also the ones that perhaps Dr. Lee was referring to, who really are the most challenged with being able to remember to wash their hands and watch their distance and keep those masks on. I do think that there are things that the schools can do to mitigate the risk, and those are very well published on the central or the CDC's website on what the schools can do. Some of that is alternating days of who's going to school and maybe doing some other things. So there are ways to mitigate it, but there's no doubt that going back to school definitely does increase the risk of COVID-19 spreading. And it is very true that we don't know post Labor Day what will have happened. I'm hoping that there was less, socializing without masks, without distance. I'm hoping there's less of that than went on over 4th of July, but we're really going to know when we start to see the numbers and really keep a close eye on the numbers. And then the other thing to remember is, you know, we live in a part of the country where we can't be outside all the time. And mm-hmm. as the weather turns later on in the fall, it will definitely be more challenging, whether it's in schools or other environments, to do that social distancing and be safer. And we do know that being outdoors is a better situation than being indoors with other people.
Dr. Pate, we have a question from Kathy, and she says she loves the show and she listens all the time to the Doctor Roundtable. So Kathy, thank you for that. But here is her question. I've been watching the numbers of confirmed COVID-19 cases going down and feeling like we're getting a hold of this virus. But after listening to last week's program about limited testing of asymptomatic people, I'm wondering if that's part of the reason. And I would also like to know why this has changed. Is it because of a lack of tests or testing agents, or is it because of new recommendations from the CDC?
Well, a number of things. First of all, I just go back to the point I made earlier that, yes, we're seeing cases go down. But again, let's keep this in perspective. We're still in a worse place than we were back in March and April. So it's good news, bad news. And we've always been missing asymptomatic people. Yes, we do pick up some on testing, but and there's been some periods of time where we've been able to do more asymptomatic testing than others, but I don't think it's made a material difference. And, you know, the estimates are that there's, you know, another 4 to 10 times, whatever the number of cases is, of asymptomatic people out there. But we've always been limited. Our testing has been limited. Our test kits, our test reagents, our testing equipment. There's been many, many limitations, not to mention the cost. And that's a real barrier to doing asymptomatic testing, because really, if you think about a disease transmission like what we have, if you are going to try to control this by just testing everybody, you'd have to be testing people on probably at least a weekly basis. And at $100, $140 a pop, whatever it is, that quickly becomes untenable. Our real option is when we can get rapid tests that are inexpensive, because even with, you know, recent, there's a lot of variability in terms of when you can get tests back. Sometimes we can get a test result back in a day or two. Other times it's a week or two. And frankly, telling somebody who's asymptomatic that they were negative a week ago isn't particularly helpful because of risks that may have incurred since then. So, and then as to the point of the CDC, I think all of us saw that recommendation for what it was. That was political interference. I don't know anybody that's embraced that part of the guidance. So I don't think that's really a contributor. I think it's just that we have limited testing. We've had a lot of cases, and those cases that are being reported are largely symptomatic, and there's a lot of them. So let's just all kind of understand that we still have a lot of spread out there, a lot of risk out there. It is good as going down, but for the reasons I mentioned earlier, it may not last long.
And Dr. McGeorge, we have a question from Jessica and her husband, and she would like to hear from all of the doctors about this, but I'd like to start with you, Dr. McGeorge. She asks, as of right now, what are the doctor's thoughts on regional travel during the holiday season of 2020? And if people are planning on traveling, even with a mask on, would it be safe to hug family members? So, Dr. McGeorge, your thoughts on that?
Gosh, I can really sympathize with this question. My own family celebrated my father's 80th birthday via Zoom. So it was not, you know, it's tough and not being able to visit. I personally think I still am very concerned about travel and visiting. And there are several things you have to think about. So one is, if you are going to visit someone, first thing to think about is, are you going to introduce risk to them? And so that really means, you know, have you in what you do, whether it's masking, social distancing, hand washing, exposures, just general risk of exposure, are you now introducing that risk to whomever you visit? And you have to think about them. Are they elderly, frail, immune compromised? Even if they're not any of those, are they following the general, you know, health guidelines of wearing masks and social distancing? And so, because they also could then put you at risk. Other things to really think about is, you know, where are we in the pandemic? And as Dr. Pate has outlined a couple of times, I mean, we are, even though we're in a better spot than we were a month ago, we are still seeing significantly more COVID-19 now than we were back during our first peak. So there is no avoidance of risk when you travel. There are things you can do to mitigate the risk. I mean, certainly traveling in your own car just with household members is less risky than going through an airport or on a bus or something like that. But still, there are always going to be risks. The last thing I would say is just a practical perspective is, you know, we have seen different states as well as the CDC have different we're changing guidelines and rules if you are returning to the state, and even different employers have rules if you've traveled and then want to return to work. So there certainly have been situations where people feel comfortable or feel like it's okay to travel, and then they're kind of stuck because the state then expects them to quarantine when they return from a high-risk area. So just that's really the practical point, but there's no guarantee with travel that you won't get COVID-19.
And Dr. Lee, any other thoughts on that question?
Yeah, I would just echo everything that Dr. McGeorge has said. The only thing I would add into that question is that I don't think it would be safe to hug your family members. That seems like a really good way to transmit, even if you're both wearing masks. So things like that, which are things that you can do to mitigate, you can wash your hands, you can wear a mask, but trying to avoid those type of really close interactions would be best avoid if you are going to make that travel.
And Dr. Pate, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think Dr. McGeorge really laid it out well, and Dr. Lee's comments are good. And I think the other thing is we need to assess where we are I assume we're talking mostly about December. We need to see where we are. As I've mentioned, I think the disease activity is going to be worse, not better. And the higher the disease activity, then the more dangerous it is. So let's check and see how the disease activity there is, and then get back on Idaho Matters back in November or December and ask us the question again. But I agree with everything Dr. McGeorge and Lee said.
And Dr. Lee, before we take a break, we have another travel-related question. The person says, my wife and I plan to fly to the Midwest to visit family at the end of October. Is it safer to wear two masks on the plane than one? Maybe a surgical mask over a cloth mask with a filter. Would that be hard to tolerate for several hours? What do you think?
Well, as someone who's had to wear several masks, my N95 plus a surgical mask, that is not an easy thing to do. And I don't think you're really going to have a lot of benefit from wearing two masks versus one. Remember, the point of the mask is you're trying to avoid droplet transmission to another person. And so having one mask on, I think, would be appropriate. A surgical mask is considered to be a little bit better than a cloth mask, but either one of those would be appropriate when you're talking about masking. I don't think that you would get a lot of benefit from wearing two masks. It is something you can do. I sometimes wear it for 8 to 12 hours and it's not fun, but it's not unsafe. It's just, I don't think that in that situation, you're going to get a lot of extra protection with those particular masks.
Dr. Pate, before we get to our listener questions, I'd like to talk a little bit about this vaccine trial being halted. I believe it's AstraZeneca yesterday temporarily halted its phase 3 trials of a possible coronavirus vaccine after one patient suffered some type of health issue. So the trial was halted. Is this common in trials like this? And if it is just one person, is it normal, I guess, to halt the trial?
Yeah, so it's certainly not a rare event. And, what happens is after we go through phase 1 and 2 trials, which may be as few as a few dozen patients, and then go into phase 3 trials, where I think most of these companies are trying to use something on the order of 30,000 subjects, we are going to see things. Now, as Dr. Lee and Dr. McGeorge know, not everything we see is due to the vaccine. So there are still people that get illnesses all the time, whether they're getting a vaccine or not. What I think is that this is incredibly reassuring, frankly. There's been a lot of concern about, is a vaccine going to be rushed? Is it going to be safe? And I have to give kudos to AstraZeneca here. It's one person, it's a subject in UK, They don't know that it's due to the vaccine, but in an abundance of caution, they've paused the study to look at this and make sure that it's not the vaccine causing this. And I think that's wonderful because they know that they're going to pay a price for that. In fact, their stock fell 6% yesterday and over this, but they did the right thing. I think the other thing that's very promising is we heard 9 pharmaceutical companies come together and pledge that they would not ask for early approval of their vaccines. They're going to study them. And so while we've got some reason not to trust our federal government and to be a little bit disappointed with the FDA, I think that actually we're seeing really good behavior from these pharmaceutical makers. And so we'll keep that study participant in our prayers, hope that this turns out not to be anything serious, and we'll especially hope it doesn't turn out to be something related to that vaccine, because I'm particularly interested in that vaccine as it uses it's got a little tweak to it that might mean that it'll give us more durable immunity. We're waiting for those study results, but I hope it works out.
Dr. McGeorge, we have a question from Dan. He sent this on Twitter. He says, what seems to be the difference between the European and Asian strains of the virus, and why is the European strain not as lethal?
Yeah, so the virus started out, of course, it was originally a strain from Asia. And early on in the spring, there was actually a mutation. And the mutation is just one single point on that DNA can then cause a change in the proteins. And what that mutation did was it actually changed the protein, one of the proteins on the sticky part of the virus that sticks to the cells that it tends to infect. And so we do know that this virus, the European strain, likely actually is more contagious than the original Asian strain. However, I don't think that there's any evidence, I've not seen any evidence that the European strain per se is more lethal. It just is that it's likely more contagious. It is the dominant strain now in the U.S., although both strains are in the U.S.
So, Dr. McGeorge, is that why I read a news article the other day saying when we get this second wave in the U.S. that we could see a lot more cases but less fatalities?
Well, you know, viruses, just like everything else, I mean, DNA mutates. So we actually could see another mutation. I mean, there have been other mutations, but this is the most significant change. So certainly there could be other mutations. I think the death rate. So I think that there's so many variables. It is possible that if you have something more contagious and less lethal, you would have a lower death rate. I mean, certainly we know that influenza, for example, is highly contagious. And even though it is lethal, can be lethal, it is less lethal than COVID-19. Mm. So that the lethality of the virus or a mutation could make a difference. I don't think that's really what's going on here. I think, you know, one of the things with lethality with the COVID-19 virus is, a couple of things. One is, as it has gone on, we've learned things. I mean, some things that maybe back in February and March in the world were just being tried with patients with severe COVID disease. We have now learned some things and made some changes. And there are some therapies available, although not super effective. There are some things that have been shown to be helpful. The other issue, though, with lethality really has to do with overwhelming the healthcare in that community. And we saw that, certainly saw that in Italy. I think we saw that in New York. I think, you know, when you look at the lethality back in April in New York, it was higher than we're seeing now. And at least some of that may be that we now understand more and have learned more. But a lot of that is that the healthcare infrastructure was just absolutely oversaturated, and really challenged to meet the needs of all the patients. And that infrastructure is not just beds and buildings, it is people and people that are able to take care of really sick patients. So that's respiratory therapists, critical care nurses, and doctors, particularly, again, doctors that are specialized and able to take care of hospitalized and critically ill patients.
Dr. Lee, Tiffany just emailed us saying so many people who are getting very mild symptoms are quick to assume they just have a cold. So she's curious about two things. Do we know how prevalent the common cold is right now in the Treasure Valley? And then secondly, what is more contagious, a cold or COVID? Do we even know those answers?
Well, that's a good question. And I would say just from my experience in the emergency department, I haven't seen a lot of what I would say cold symptoms yet. I've seen a few here that, but again, you have to remember that even cold symptoms can be COVID-19, and coronavirus is a common cold as well. So the viruses can be very similar. And so it can be difficult to tell those two apart. I find this question to be especially difficult when you're managing people with a more benign, or the symptoms aren't as bad. So people who have a runny nose, cough, cold symptoms, you know, during the summertime, it was easy to say that a lot of those people probably had COVID because we're not seeing a lot of the colds that go through in the fall. But as it starts to get fall time, we're going to get that mix. We're going to get some people who will have mild COVID-19 symptoms, and we're going to get some people who have normal cold symptoms. And so finding those two out is really something where testing will be really helpful. But the thing to remember is that whether you have a cold or whether you have COVID-19, you should really probably not be around other people. And so when you talk about the practicality of it, that if you're sick, you should be staying home. And whether that's COVID-19 or whether it's, you know, one of the other coronaviruses, one of the cold ones, you should still be staying home. And so as we get more rapid testing, we'll hopefully be able to tell a little bit better in people whether or not they have COVID-19 or not.
But that is so critical. Like if you're not feeling well at all, even if it feels like just a cold, right now you need to stay home. Good advice, Dr. Lee. Dr. Pate, an anonymous listener from Nampa has a question. She says, recently there has been more coverage in the national news about long haulers, COVID patients who have had residual and long-lasting health problems of all kinds resulting from contracting COVID. Are these patients being monitored and tracked here in Idaho by the medical community? And if so, how are they receiving help and what research is being done?
So we're still trying to understand what is going on. There clearly is something going on. We've had, for people that don't know what the term long haulers is, I was talking with a group this morning and they thought, oh, well, maybe that means that truck drivers are at high risk. No, we're not talking about truck drivers. We're talking about people that have contracted COVID and then 4, 5, 6 months are still having profound symptoms. And when we look at these groups, there's not many studies on them, but there's been a couple. When we look at these groups, one study found these were people in their, on average, in their late 30s. Another group, another study showed it was people averaging age in low 40s. There is a slight female predominance, which is interesting because males typically get more severe disease than females. So this is quite interesting, and we don't understand that. And they have a range of symptoms. But what is really striking about this is that many of these people were considered themselves very, very healthy before this happened, and quite active, and now find that just getting out of bed is fatiguing, that they may have to stop when just climbing one flight of stairs because they're tired. So they're having some profound effects. There is no reporting of these cases that I'm aware of, and it may come, but currently there's no reporting of them. They are getting cared for. There's a few centers, not many, in the country that have set up special programs to care for these kind of patients. Most that I'm aware of are already booked up for a year, so it's very hard to get into. So most of this care is going to be delivered by the primary care physicians. And then I'll just say one last thing to tie in. The other thing that we have recently discovered, this of concern, is a high frequency of myocarditis and inflammation of the heart muscle in people after COVID. And so some of these long haulers do complain of palpitations, chest pains, shortness of breath with exertion. These are people now, in light of the fact that we've discovered this myocarditis, probably need to get an evaluation to make sure that their hearts are okay.
Dr. Pate, maybe you can answer this. And if not, we can go to our other doctors. Alicia just wrote in, I recently became aware that the Idaho House of Representatives passed a resolution to suspend all COVID restrictions on approximately August 25th. While I realize this would still need to pass the Senate, does anyone know what the status of this legislation is?
Have not heard or how likely it is to pass the Senate. So I don't have any information on that.
Right. And I was looking myself and I don't believe we actually know where it is. So it may be suspended and the next legislative session doesn't start until January. So this issue would not even be taken up until January.
Right.
So just FYI for anyone who was paying attention to the special session, we have to wait until January to frankly see where we are with our numbers. And then if something like this would even go to the Senate. Dr. McGeorge, Elizabeth wants to know this. She says she was in a doctor's office this last week and the PA told her that she doesn't trust the COVID numbers in our state. So she told Elizabeth that if someone tests positive for COVID-19 in Idaho, their entire household is then also counted as positive. And Elizabeth says, this does not sound right to me. Can you sort this out?
Yes, Gemma, I would say it's actually the opposite of that. And so what has happened, again, there was conversation earlier in this podcast about not having enough testing to test asymptomatic people and contacts. There are some situations where there is contact tracing done, but in general, if one person has symptoms of COVID and they are tested and test positive, that one person is then reported for having COVID. And certainly early on when we had the drive-up tent testing, there could be five people in a family in a car with symptoms consistent with COVID. And we just tested, let them choose who they felt was the sickest in their family or most likely and tested that person. And then we just assume, and they need to behave as if they all also have COVID. But those four other cases in the car never got tested and therefore never were reported. There are other situations, and I've seen them in the local press, of situations where people have documented COVID-19 and they have other family members who are sick at home and who they just presume have COVID-19 but never went through the testing. So it's very clear that the numbers are actually an undercounting of even symptomatic people with COVID, let alone all the asymptomatic people that we've missed.
So let's be really clear on this. If you have not personally had a COVID test, you are not going to be counted as having COVID.
Correct.
Dr. Pate, Allison just wrote in and she says, if I get COVID-19 and I recover, should I seek to donate my antibodies? And if so, are there any places in our area that's collecting or using antibodies in treatment?
Yes. If she wants to donate her plasma, and that's very generous of her, she can contact the American Red Cross and that she can access. They will and determine whether she does have antibodies and if they're suitable for the convalescent plasma.
So go to the American Red Cross, because I do believe locally they are collecting that.
That's correct.
Yeah. And Dr. Lee, Ingrid just sent us this email and she says, can you explain how a statewide positivity rate is calculated when reported results from the hospitals are different? And how home tests will be used or tests by employers to influence the positivity rate. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And, you know, each, I can speak mostly from a hospital standpoint, and maybe Dr. Pate can speak to the statewide, but in the hospital, we have a known number of people that we test and a known number of people that test positive. And so that's how we come up with our positivity rate. And speaking with other hospitals around the system, that's pretty similar. You know, how the home tests and these employer tests will come into it is a little unclear. I don't know that they have the same reporting recommendation or reporting requirements to the state. And so that may be, it may be difficult to calculate, but again, we're always dealing with a number that's not going to be exact, whether it be because we're not testing people, whether it be because some of those tests are outside of our system and reported in other ways. And so I think there's a lot of questions about the numbers and testing and things like that. And I think the idea is not to look at a single point, but more to look at the data overall. You know, what is our overall sort of rate of patients or people who have testing positive? What is our overall rate of hospitalization? Things like that, I think, are much more important than that specific number. Those are things you can use to help predict what's going to happen. But you'll see there's going to be variation in different reporting, whether you're looking at the newspaper, whether you're looking at the Idaho website. So I just would caution people to not look at the numbers so closely in that regard, but just as a general sense, because you can get a sense from looking at them as to whether or not we're doing well or whether or not we're not.
And Dr. McGeorge, maybe you can answer this. Chris and Salmon emailed us wanting to know, where is the best source for accurate COVID case counts?
Yeah, to what Dr. Lee just said, there are multiple sources.
Right.
I look at the globalepidemics.org website, which is public health website. I think it was put out by Harvard, also Brown School of Public Health is part of that Harvard Global Health Initiative. And you can really drill down to the area also and see where we are with COVID. And I think in Idaho, being a large state, it's very helpful to look in the region or in the county to see where we are. There was a time, maybe about 6 weeks ago, that our rates and I don't know if people remember the huge surge that they were having in the South, and Houston was on the news. And there was a time that our COVID rates in Canyon County were higher than they were in Harris County, which is the home of Houston. So I think it's really important to kind of keep an eye, not just on what's going on nationally, but how it can vary county to county within the state of Idaho.
And I want to leave on a bit of levity, because we don't get to do that normally, especially on this program on Wednesdays with our medical experts. But Dr. Lee, your wife wrote in and wanted to and wanted to say in regards to hugging people. She said it's nearly impossible for her not to hug people, but she knows that it's always a risk. So she just tries to make it a quote very dry hug, and she turns her head and makes it quick. So still,
yes,
probably not
sounds,
the best thing to do.
Sounds about like my wife.
I figured it might. I want to thank all of you for taking this entire hour out of your day to talk with us. Just so appreciate your factual, accurate information. It is so important that we still make sure we get these questions answered. Our guest today, Dr. David Pate, Dr. Laura McGeorge, and Dr. Darren Lee. Remember, if you have questions for our medical experts for next week, email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Thank you all, and we will see you back here tomorrow.